I'd like to summarize from my own observation the question of how to study the spirit of prophecy. I've included some things in your paper, but I'm going to depart from it. Some of it you'll find there and some you may not. I've just made a list of suggestions. I've talked about this many times, and I keep changing my list and varying it some. So this may not follow exactly what you have there, but you'll find some things there. I'd like to suggest these quick points in terms of study of the spirit of prophecy that have been helpful to me. I would say, number one, that as I read, I must realize that the messages are first of all to me. In the Bible, we have the letters to Timothy and Titus and Philemon and the churches. When I read the counsel of the spirit of prophecy, I want to put my name in the place. I think that's important. If we feel that it's been inspired, then I think we can find something for ourselves. I remember when we had the testimony countdown program back in 1969, we had a part of that program where people gave testimonies as to their study of the week. And one of the things that we suggested was, tell us what you found in your study that you found helpful and important and significant. And I'll never forget one lady who stood up and she said, you know, I decided at the beginning of this study that everything I read this week that I felt applied to me, I would try to apply it. Well, she says, I went through the study this week, and when I came to the end, I couldn't find anything that didn't apply. Well, perhaps that's true. But I think sometimes, you know, there are things that were written to different people in different circumstances. But I find this a very basic point. As I study the Bible, I look to it for guidance as to my own life. And I think this would be true in studying of the spirit of prophecy. Number two, I would study everything available on a subject. Ellen White has said the testimonies themselves will be the key that will explain the messages given as Scripture is explained by Scripture. That's Selected Messages, Book 1, page 42. If you study everything that's available, I think you'll find this will be a tremendous help to you, whatever the case may be. Yes. Selected Messages, Book 1, page 42. I think with this in mind, we might look at several other side thoughts, and of course we could go in different directions, but basically, as far as possible, find all that you have. One of the things that this will do, it'll help to give you a balance. I think of an example of this is the statement that we have in messages to young people on photographs, photography. Now, this particular statement by some is thought to be very restricting in terms of taking pictures and what we should or shouldn't do in regard to pictures. I think if you read it carefully, you'll not find it extreme, but it is rather strong, and it might lead some to believe that you should never take a picture of any kind. I think along with this, you might find the statement that is in Selected Messages, and I'm sorry I don't have the page in front of me here, but there Ellen White talks about people who take an extreme in terms of pictures where they wouldn't even wear a watch because it had a face on it. That was a picture. That was in Europe. Now, when you put the two together, you have, I think, a balance on this subject. And I think this is helpful in understanding photography. And, of course, if you look further, you discover that Ellen White had pictures taken of herself at various times, so that she was not against pictures per se, but the extreme to which it was taken. Either way, she was very careful, for example, in choosing pictures for her books, illustrations. She wanted to make sure they were just right. She often talked about the illustrations that were in our periodical. Sometimes she liked them, sometimes she didn't. And so she was conscious that pictures had a positive place But they ought to be kept in balance. You remember the statement in messages to young people, that people that take pictures over and over and they fill their houses with the pictures. I don't know whether she was talking about grandparents. I have a grandson, and I tell you, it's awful hard not to take his picture. He's the most beautiful grandson ever born. Just ask me. But anyway, you know, we have to be careful. And one of those, and you know, in that statement, she says, you know, they keep taking pictures hoping that everyone will be better and even better than the original. Now, I think what she's saying is, you know, I finally get a picture that looks even better than I look. And, well, that's interesting. Anyway, study everything on the subject. A third point I would suggest is we need to consider when it was written. I like to state this way, this statement, time and place. Time and place is important. When was it written? What were the circumstances? What can we learn about this? And as much as you can learn about it, I think is helpful. A classic example in this regard is a statement that Ellen White made that we find in Education, page 216 and 217, and perhaps some of you as teachers have used this, or as pastors, where Ellen White says that if girls could learn to drive and harness a horse, they would be better fitted to meet the emergencies of life. Have you read that in Education? That's an interesting statement. If girls could learn to harness and drive a horse, they'd be better fitted to meet the emergencies of life. I've met with different classes, and I've asked how many girls know how to harness and drive a horse, and I don't find very many. Well, you know the answer, don't you? It's a car. In fact, they might even learn how to change a tire. Well, I got a little close to somebody there, didn't I? Well, I've had fun with this statement because, you know, it says every girl should learn to drive and harness a horse, and I've talked about it in a classroom, particularly with Academy-age students, and it talks about girls learning to use a shovel and a hoe. And in other words, what she's really saying, it seems to me, is that a woman ought to learn to do what men normally are considered to be doing. I consider Ellen White one of the earliest women's libbers in the better sense of the term. Well, now you got the head of my story here. See, now that's like Paul Harvey. That's the rest of the story, because I'll get all the boys in the class to agree. My, they'd like to have a girl that would know how to use a shovel and so forth. And I said, now would you girls like to know what she says about boys? And yes, we'd like to hear. So you read on, and she says, it won't make any boy less manly if he makes his bed, he washes dishes, he learns to sweep the floor. And you should hear the girls cheer. You see the balance there. And of course, you have to remember that when it was written. And of course, this is important. There's another example I'd like to refer to, and I'm not sure it's in the paper, but I have it in my notes here in front of me. It's in the volume 7 of the Testimonies, page 83 and 84, where Ellen White is talking about hospitals or sanitariums. And she's suggesting in that particular statement that our sanitariums or hospitals should be made of wood, not masonry or brick. Or stone. Now, what do you do with a statement like that? Someone would say, well, Ellen White's just a product of her time. You know, you can see how old-fashioned she is. You ought to build hospitals out of wood. Well, now, wait just a minute. If you look carefully at the statement, you discover that Ellen White gives certain reasons. And this will lead to another point that we want to make, but it applies here in terms of when it was written and this idea of how to study. When Ellen White wrote this comment about sanitariums, the wood and she talks about it. She says the brick and the masonry are not healthy. They're damp. They're unhealthy, uncomfortable. They're very expensive. She lists several things about sanitariums in that setting. Well, what was the situation? Well, when she wrote this particular statement, there was no central air conditioning. Oh, I hate to bring that up again. No central heating. If you go to some of these old houses of that time, how did they heat them? Fireplaces. Stoves, fireplaces. Sometimes if you go to some of these big buildings, you'll find fireplaces in several rooms. Have you ever been to the White House in Washington, D.C.? You'll notice there that there are fireplaces in several of the rooms. Well, of course, that goes back to, a long time ago when that was the way the White House was cared for in terms of heat. So, because of this, a wood building would be drier with the fireplaces as they were, and it would be less expensive to maintain and so forth. Well, what's the situation today? Well, just almost the reverse is true. The wood building is not practical anymore. In fact, you couldn't build a wooden hospital today. They wouldn't let you. The central air conditioning and central heating provides for uniformity of the air in a hospital. And so the hospital today that's built of brick and masonry and with central air conditioning and heating is the way to go. Now, when you understand Ellen White's statement that was made way back then in that light, then you understand why she made it. And so you have to think again of the time and circumstance in which she wrote. Another point that I would quickly make, and that is that the messages are up to date if we understand them as they were given. I think it's a principle. The principle is there. And I would say, if you were to make another way of saying this, their principle is still valid. I remember some time ago I had a representative of David C. Cook Company in my office. This is the largest producer of Sunday school materials. And he'd come to my office. I had made an inquiry about something. We were working with Bible textbooks at the time, and I'd made an inquiry, and they sent a personal representative to my office in Washington. And he'd never heard of a Seventh-day Adventist before, or at least didn't know much about them. And on my desk at that time, I had all of the Ellen White books on my desk, the whole set of them. And he was curious. We talked about other things, and then he said, what are these? I said, well, these are books written by Ellen White. My office here is involved with her writing. We believe that she had the gift of prophecy, and we believe that they have special meaning for us. And then I said, of course, she died back in 1915. Well, he says, that's a long time ago. He said, are they still applicable? Long time. Well, I said, yes, we believe that they are in principle, and the ideas there are still valid. I said, would you like me to read something about young people or children from a book? Now, that was kind of a dangerous question. I said, now, I don't know what you want me to read, but here's a book, and I picked up, as I recall, it was either Adventist Home or Child Guidance. I think it was Adventist Home. I picked it up, and I said, now here's some headings of chapters. Where would you like me to read? I was young and foolish then, I guess. You know, it's a little dangerous sometimes, but I felt impressed to go that way, and so I said, where would you like me to read? Well, he said, why don't you read something, and I think the area he chose was preparation for marriage. So I turned to the chapter and I said, well, let me just start reading. So I read a paragraph or two, and I'll never forget his response after I read about preparation for marriage in that chapter. He said, you know, that's better than Dear Abby. It is, isn't it? Well, you see, there's an up-to-dateness of it, and I think rightly understood, of course, it continues to have value and importance for us. Another question, and we could look at many, we should not be disturbed by imperfections. You know, one's understanding of inspiration is tested here. We must remember that, as with the Bible writers, it was not word for word, verbal, whatever other word you might use. The writer, of course, was able to use their own words. And by the way, I don't know whether we've discussed it, but I think one of the very most important reasons why inspiration is not verbal is that the Bible can be translated into any language of the world, because we're not talking about words as much, although words are important. We're talking as we are concepts and principles and ideas. What would we do, for example, in regard to the Bible, if we would think that it was verbally inspired and you only could best understand it by knowing the original language? You couldn't translate it into French or German or Spanish or Portuguese or English. We always get such an interesting smile out of this, and George referred to it this morning, about people who say, well, you know, there's only one, and that's the original, that's the King James. Well, you know, that's just not true. It was in Hebrew and Aramaic, Greek, and so forth. And so I think that's an important point to remember in regard to the council, not to be disturbed by the imperfections. It may not be exactly as we might have stated it. I've included this statement, I think, in my paper, but it comes from Great Controversy, page 527. While God has given ample evidence for faith, He will never remove all excuse for unbelief. All who look for hooks to hang their doubts upon will find them. All who look for hooks. Distrust of God is the natural outgrowth of the unrenewed heart, which is at enmity with Him. But faith will flourish only as it is cherished. That's Great Controversy. It's a beautiful statement, page 527. I think it's in your paper. I would say quickly two or three other things, and we don't have time to look at them in detail, but I would say study for counsel, not to prove your preconceived ideas. Study as a learner, rather than going to it with preconceived ideas as to what you think it should say. This certainly is true of both the Bible and the Spirit of Prophecy, but I must come to this reading as a learner. I would say another point that I would make is that the counsel should be applied consistently. We've already talked about that point earlier. There are some professed believers, she says in Volume 9 of the Testimonies 154, who accept certain portions of the testimonies as the message of God while they reject those portions that condemn their favorite indulgences. I think we mentioned that statement earlier. Another quick point I would make, and this is probably a difficult one for many of us. I would be tolerant of others who do not believe exactly as I do. Somewhere along the way, I would like to share with you the statement by James White. I don't have it right in front of me here, where he talks about the perils of being a reformer. In an editorial in the Review, he deals with the problem that Ellen White often faced of being a reformer. The point of it is that she makes certain statements, and then some people who are ready to just run to an extreme take off with them. And then he says, in order to save the cause from disaster, she has to tell them, now wait a minute, don't take it to that extreme. And then there are others who don't do anything. And he makes the point, he says, what happens is that those who go to an extreme, she tries to bring back, and then when she tries to calm them down, then those who haven't done anything uses an excuse to continue to do nothing. And here you go, she's in the middle. It's a classic statement from James White in regard to being a health reformer, but we must be tolerant of others. I remember as a young evangelist, I was young once. And I remember we had evangelistic meetings in which we had people who began coming to church before they really knew, you know, what many of us, the Seventh-day Adventists, may know. And some of them had certain physical evidences of their life before becoming Adventists. And I remember the church really looking at these people very strangely. And they said, what in the world? What are these people? And they tended to just kind of back off from them. You've never seen anything like that, have you? And we had to really, really deal with this problem. You know, how can a person who has heard truth 6 months ago have the same understanding and practice of it of someone who has known it for 30 years? It's just not possible. They might have a better understanding. You may be right there. It hasn't all of the encumbrances sometimes of someone who has misread it. That's a good point. I'll have to put that in my notes for the next time. It's very true. But you know, each of us, no matter what we are, we need to be tolerant of others who are not exactly like we are, or who haven't progressed as much as we have. Yes. Well, that's a very pertinent question. Obviously, the Lord loves the sinner but hates the sin. And I think that's a practical application. We are to love the sinner but hate the sin. But we can do, I think, many times something to help educate rather than to stand away from them and criticize. Yeah, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, it's... I think that's the answer, that we surely must not tolerate sin, but we must be tolerant of the fact that someone else doesn't know it's sin. Well, you... You just can't do that. And I think that's one of the problems that some of our institutions face on the other side. You discover in a school setting that you have the privilege and the responsibility of setting certain bounds and regulations, and I think they ought to be observed. I think that's one problem that faces us in some of our institutions today, in some of our homes today. We haven't set some bounds, and we haven't given good reasons for setting bounds. And as a consequence, we are slipping away from some things we should know. When I say be tolerant, I hope it's not read that way, that we ought to just say, well, forget it, and it's not too serious. But patiently educate to better. Rather than be a critic, sit in the seat of the critic, we need to by example as well as by word to educate. Yes.
If we have a member of the church that does do, you know, some sort of open sin, and after carefully explaining to them, you know, what the church's feelings are on that, and showing them the Bible and so forth, to the point where they understand, you know, the church's position, and they know it's a sin, that they refuse to stop, then what should we do? Should we still tolerate them as a member?
Well, the question is, what do we do about a member who is openly doing wrong? We've educated them, we've tried to give them counsel and direction, and still they persist in this. It depends, I think, in a lot of ways as to what it may be. If it's a major departure from Adventism, if it's an open and glaring difference from what we believe, I think that's perhaps different than maybe an application of something. I can think of some people who, for instance, will struggle with certain habits that they know are wrong, that we would consider wrong, and we'd talk to them about it, but they would certainly still be able to fellowship. But there are some things that if you do openly and it's known within the community and within the church, then I think you do have some responsibility of disfellowshipping. We do that. Yes?
I think we just need a discerning spirit. We had a lady who was not a member of our church attending church and prayer meeting. And during the prayer meeting, we were going through this notes and papers on the spirit of prophecy. And she was reading, we were taking turns reading, and we came to a series of statements on health reform and dress reform. And one of those statements was a very hard statement on the wearing of jewelry. Now this dear lady, who was not an Adventist, was bedecked with jewelry. Mm-hmm. And I decided we hadn't missed a word from the beginning of the book. When we came to that statement, I just turned the page and went on to the next paragraph. And one of the dear brothers in the group, he wasn't about to let me get away with that. And so he insisted that we go back and read that paragraph, and I insisted that we weren't, and we went on. If it had been the head elder's wife who was had shown up in jewelry that night, we probably would have read it twice. I think we just have to show some discernment.
It's a process of education in all of these areas, and that's right. I think discernment is important, and of course, an understanding that we have a raw obligation to train and to develop this. Yes.
I appreciate you mentioning tolerance. Our young friend there mentioned open sin. I know a couple of church members who are using sugar in their desserts, open sin. What do you do with those folks? Well, burn them or something. We need to develop that sort of tolerance because in the setting that I'm familiar with right now, some of our folks are very interested in arousing the saints. Why don't they know more about such and such? If they don't know more about it, obviously they're unconverted. And that spirit of intolerance really creates a terrible schism that we need to develop a way of
dependency. Yes, this is very important. Well, yes, and I, in responding to his question, I would agree with you on this too, that some people would consider something terrible sin, that others would say, that's a peripheral item. Again, patience and tolerance is needed, certainly. And I suggest this in connection with the writing of Ellen White and with the Bible, too. And that brings me to a final point I want to make. We've gone just a bit past 11:20, but you have been tolerant, I hope. I would say, and related to this other one, and we could have made a list three times this long, that God doesn't reject me if I fall short. If I don't do it perfectly at the first. We could illustrate this in many ways in regard to Ellen White. Briefly, I would tell you that when the first of our colleges was built in Battle Creek, Ellen White was shown that we should build a college. By the way, that was an interesting college. The students were age 7 to 45. It wasn't a college as we know it quite today in the beginning, but at that particular time, she was suggesting the building of a college. They agreed. She also suggested we should build on a large piece of property. They disagreed. When it came to the dedication of the college, which they built on about 7 acres instead of a larger property that she had hoped they would build on, they came to Ellen White and asked if she would speak at the dedication. Now, if you had been in Ellen White's place, what would you have done? They followed part of the council, but they just turned their back upon this idea of on a large campus. They said, we don't need it, and so they had turned away from part of the council. Well, she spoke at the dedication. And she was aware that perhaps they weren't ready yet to accept it all that they had started. And I think this is an important point to remember as we study. Sometimes as I read the Council of the Spirit of Prophecy, I think, my, what a standard. Mm. Like sometimes when I read, I can only read a few pages, and I have to just sit down and think about it a while, because it's so rich and so full and so complete, and sometimes so challenging. But I think Ellen White herself has demonstrated to us this particular principle, that God doesn't give up on us if we don't do it absolutely perfectly the first time, but we ought not to quit. Another illustration of this is a series of letters Ellen White wrote to a doctor and his wife by the name of Sanderson. She wrote several letters to them over a period of several months in 1901, 1902. And finally, Mrs. Sanderson replied. She was puzzled about some of the things Ellen White had written to her, and she finally wrote, and in the letter she wrote something like this. I don't have the exact words in front of me. But she said, "We've been concerned about what you've been writing. We haven't understood everything that you've said. But," she said, "we finally decided that we would live up to what we could understand." And then she said, "we thought that maybe the Lord would help us to understand the rest." I think that's beautiful. To live up to what you do understand and to do what you can. And of course, it can't be in our power, obviously. The Lord promises power. But as we do live up to what we understand, I think the Lord will bless us and will help us to grow in our understanding and development. Well, there are many other things we could say on it, but these are just a few points from my own personal approach to the study of Scripture and the Spirit of Prophecy that I hope might be helpful to you.
This concludes another lecture from the 1986 E.G. White Estate Prophetic Guidance Seminar held at Andrews University. As a service to the church and in cooperation with the E.G. White Estate, this has been a special American Cassette Ministries production. International copyright, 1986, all rights reserved. For additional copies of this message or for other outstanding educational and inspirational cassettes, please write to American Cassette Ministries. Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, zip 17108. Waiting to serve you. This is American Cassette Ministries. We're a nonprofit corporation helping prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ.